in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and I am so glad that our good friend Dr. Art Sear has made his way through the gray and rain and wind of Mother Nature to join us for his monthly visit to the morning show. Dr. Art Sear, author of After the Cold War, and someone whose columns appear in newspapers and journals across the country and beyond our borders as well, and who joins us each and every month to offer his thoughts and analysis on various issues and concerns. And we have a good juicy list of topics to be approaching today, and so I'm especially grateful for this opportunity to engage with Professor Sear once again. Dr. Art Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's always a pleasure, and it's nice to be invited back, and I'm glad the offerings are juicy.
I don't usually
hear that.
Right, yeah, juicy stuff today. And, of course, probably the juiciest of them all is the matter of the U.S. economy, and you wrote a really interesting and compelling column about that a couple of weeks ago, maybe several weeks ago, and I think it was just ahead of something that made the current economy even more jittery and troublesome, namely, of course, the failure of the Silicon Valley Bank and some other failures in their wake, which, of course, for some people brought to mind the devastating bank failures that occurred some years ago that really led to widespread damage of the U.S. economy. Although your column doesn't focus on that because, of course, it was written just ahead of that, maybe we could just begin with these bank failures, and maybe you could draw a contrast between what we're seeing right now in the banking sector, the nature of these failures, versus what we saw a few years ago that touched off such a major recession.
Yeah, I'm not... I'm privileged to teach international political economy. My background's in political science, and I'm not a professional economist. Some people would say that's an advantage, but I don't have any inside information on the markets, and I'm not in any way an insightful investor, unlike all these guys that you that we see and hear on the radio and TV and the internet. So far, the 2008-2009 panic, 27 to 2009 financial panic and global recession, was a function of a lot of really bad loans in the property market. Subprime loans were packaged together and sold as financial instruments globally by very aggressive bankers and related financial types, and that led to a very significant crash. We're not seeing that today. It seems like more of a traditional bank panic, where people are, interest rates have gone up. A couple major banks, a couple on the West Coast in California and one in New York, have been taken over by federal regulators. But it does, and one major bank in Switzerland has been bought by another. The ups and downs of banking are an inevitable part of a market economy, but it does not yet seem to be global. And one of the benefits of the 2007-9 financial challenges is that banks are much more strictly regulated, not only nationally and on the part of other national banks, but also globally. Bank for International Settlements, there is a network, an international regime, as we say in poli-sci, that does collaborate and regulate and maintain liquidity. So nobody can predict the future, whatever we might hear from these guys on the media accurately and confidently, but it doesn't seem like that kind of crisis, and banks have much stricter reserve requirements. A truly dedicated public servant, Paul Volcker, V-O-L-C-K-E-R, now deceased, he spent his whole career working in government, in administrations of both parties, as head of the Fed, a Jimmy Carter nominee, though he served under Reagan. He's credited rightly with breaking the back of inflation and ending the terrible regime of stagflation that we suffered, those of us who were around, in the 70s. And into the 1980s, and as an advisor to the Obama administration, President Obama and associates deserve a lot of credit for bringing Volcker back. He was able to work with the administration, persuaded Congress for the stricter rules. It was very free and easy during the good times of the 1990s, and with 2020 hindsight, President Clinton and Alan Greenspan, the head of the Fed, were more flexible and liberal than they should have been in breaking down New Deal regulations, especially regarding the banking industry.
And so some of those regulations had to come back. Yeah, in your column, you make mention in particular of the Dodd-Frank Act of 2010 that became law. And one of the things you mentioned specifically that I would love to have you just sort of clarify, because if you're no economist, I'm even less of an economist. I mean, so much of this is such a foreign language to me.
Well, we're both
fortunate, yes. but so one of the things you talk about in this Dodd-Frank Act, and you mentioned Paul Volcker by name as being instrumental in the creation of this, is a separation of commercial banking from investment banking.
Yeah.
That's a distinction I'm afraid I don't quite understand. Can you help me understand, our listeners understand, that distinction between commercial banking and investment banking, and why it's important or beneficial to separate them?
Commercial banking, the money that you and I and most people put on deposit in banks, that has always been relatively strictly regulated. Investment banking is just that, capital that is used for investments, not fixed interest rates, but that go up and down some, but investments that may or may not pay off. And since the 1930s, those two were strictly separated. And Volcker brought them back together again. The Trump administration, rather like the Clinton administration, put emphasis on deregulation, and the Volcker rule, as I understand it, again, I'm not an expert, during the crisis of the first decade of this century, brought back in that separation. But banks can no longer It's not gambling unless it's the subprime mortgage market of a decade ago. But banks can no longer use depositors' money for riskier investments. Investment banks are a separate category. And one important point that is not much mentioned is in the 1930s, the 8 or 9 major investment banks, based pretty much in New York City, they all survived the Great Depression, terrible as it was, including an always controversial, always perennial moneymaker, Goldman Sachs. They all failed during the period 2007-2009. They all failed except for Goldman Sachs. My understanding is Goldman reorganized and survived, but they're no longer a conventional investment bank. It's very complicated, but it's also very human. And one of the things that I pay attention to, it was a very different population, a much rougher time in every way of life in the 30s. But we don't seem to be so good at surviving as the men and women back then during rightly called the greatest generation. That's not a point that one regularly hears, but I think it's really an important point. We all, as citizens, should look at ourselves collectively. How are we doing?
Right. And yes, and their capacity to endure, I mean, hardship that we can scarcely even wrap our heads around.
Yeah, exactly.
It is easy for us to take that for granted or not fully appreciate that.
Yeah.
I agree completely.
Yeah, and frankly, there were financiers who were very successful, who were immigrants, mostly Jewish from Europe, especially Eastern Europe. And what was the Soviet Union, who did very, very well in finance. And there's a certain kind of toughness as well as intellect that you need to get through these ordeals. And as Americans, we should all be doing our best to try to emulate our predecessors.
Absolutely.
I hope that's clear. It's not an economic point. It's a human point.
That's important, too. Right. And it's interesting how much human tendencies and attitudes and fears and confidence play into the way an economy functions. I mean, we get scared, we panic, and suddenly things start drastically changing in the economy.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot is tied to how we function as human beings. You say in this column about the current state of the economy that we are not yet in a traditional recession. I wonder if you could just remind us of what that term means. What do we mean when we talk about a traditional recession? Is there a very specific benchmark that indicates that we're in a traditional recession, or is it just that there are certain characteristics of a recession that at the moment we're not exactly seeing?
Well, economic activity, especially production, slows down, is measured, I think, mainly by the U.S. Commerce Department, again, since the New Deal, slows down and unemployment rises. A quip that's quite popular, including with President Reagan. A recession is when your neighbor is out of work. A depression is when you are out of work. What we have is a full job market. It's quite anomalous.
Right.
Economists are always coming up with theories. American economists, especially in the 20th century, increasingly quantitative theories, and human behavior keeps undercutting them. Mm. There was something called the Phillips curve that became a major guide star during the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, when econometricians really reached a height of power. There would be a direct trade-off between unemployment and inflation. And Walter Heller, a very fine scholar and economist from the University of Minnesota, was JFK's chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors back then. He was famous for saying, managing the economy is like driving a car. If inflation is going up, we step on the brakes. If employment's going up, we step on the gas using fiscal policy. By the end of the 1960s, after 8 years of the Kennedy and Johnson types, we had inflation and unemployment both going up together.
Really?
And the door opened to stagflation. You know.
And then what do you do with the car?
As Professor Phillips from the London School of Economics would be the first to have pointed out, no, you can't. These are not laws. Human behavior keeps changing according to circumstances.
Right.
John Maynard Keynes, Lord Keynes, another great Englishman who helped guide us all, he said the same thing. You know, his name is abused, and especially by politicians on the right. No, he never said these things are fixed, and never said that fiscal policy is saved. We don't have one thing that will keep us safe and prosperous.
Right. It's interesting. The vehicle metaphor that you just used reminds me of something I heard, I think, on NPR's Marketplace about a week ago when they were talking about what the Fed is doing right now, you know, in terms of interest rates. And they said something to the effect that when the Fed attempts to slow the economy, when they put on the brakes, almost inevitably somebody gets sent through the windshield. So it's like you put on the brakes, and that might be great for, you know, like a wide portion of the economy, but there might be certain sectors in which the result of that can be negative. And I think they were pointing to maybe some of these recent bank failures.
Well, that's a really good image. Thank you.
That's interesting.
And we do have full employment. You may not get the job you want, and it may not be very pleasant, but unless you're incapacitated in a fairly serious way, jobs are available. The American economy is just a fantastic employment as well as production engine, and a big vexing problem for our leaders at the Fed especially is that they're raising interest rates to try to slow things down, but the economy is just booming, and it hasn't yet had a big effect.
Right. You mentioned, actually, in terms of, you know, some kind of bedrock principles, you know, for us to remember at this moment in time. One of them is you point to the United States as having, and you just say it very boldly, the U.S. has the most productive economy in the world. I think by the measure of our gross domestic product, and you talk about it essentially doubling every couple of decades, and this has been going on since the 1940s. So despite all the kind of the peaks and valleys that are part of any economy, you are, I think, cautioning us to not be so reactive to every dip that we aren't conscious of the general robustness of our economy, which is, from the sounds of it, the way you describe it, quite extraordinary.
Yes. Every two decades since 1940, at least in nominal terms, our GDP, as measured by the Commerce Department, has doubled. Even after the 70s, in nominal terms at least, we were way ahead of where we were before. And that is continuous. It's production more than productivity, as statistically measured by economists and others. That goes up and down. And a big fretting problem a half century ago was our productivity is going down statistically. But the gross economy overall is just a fantastic production machine.
And another principle, it's kind of your closing point in this really interesting column, is when you say this, and again, this you're saying this in the context of, you know, all that is going wrong right now in terms of bonds and many stocks and so on, but you're basically saying the basic truths of investing remain unchanged. I mean, in a world that has changed in so many drastic and dramatic ways in recent years, the essentials of investment remain the same.
And at
the heart of that, I think you're talking about just staying calm and staying the course, right?
And being very disciplined and looking at, in the age of the internet and pervasive media and more hustlers than ever before, frankly, it's really important to be very disciplined when you're examining potential investments. And I cite a book at the end, not by me, Benjamin Graham and David Dodd, Security Analysis. Benjamin Graham was a Wall Street genius, an investment banker type, who actually did quite well during the Great Depression. And David Dodd was a Columbia University business professor. They did this book that was published in 1934 called Security Analysis. And it's not going to be ripping, and you got to really focus. It's actually pretty deadly dull. But
they're not going to make a movie out of it. Is that what you're trying to
say? Not likely. No. If they do, Hollywood will have to add a lot of pizzazz.
Right.
But it's been a steady, strong seller since 1934. It's still in print. It's been occasionally updated.
Wow.
By their estates and successors, but it's the basic principles remain the same.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Art Sear. He joins us monthly to be part of the morning show and to offer up his analysis of current events. His columns, of course, appear in newspapers all across the country, and they are typically the framework by which we approach a number of really, really important topics. One of the things you wrote about in a recent topic was the most recent visit of the relatively new Chancellor of Germany, Olaf Scholz,
yes,
visiting President Joe Biden, and was actually, from the sounds of it, the second visit in a fairly short amount of time.
Yeah, one year, almost exactly.
Okay, and you made mention of the fact that some observers kind of want you know him again, or why is all this going on, and those kind of questions or criticisms really kind of missing the point of the centrality of Germany to NATO and the incredible role that NATO is playing right now in that part of the world. Tell us more about that.
He's from the Social Democratic Party. They're the chancellor leading the current ruling coalition. Angela Merkel, conservative leader of the Christian Democratic Union, Christian Social Union, a very dominant personality. She's someone I admire a lot. She really was crucial in transitioning Germany from the immediate post-Cold War period into today. She had a very interesting background, including in East Germany. She may have met Vladimir Putin, and they had a good... But to actually answer your question, Scholz has a challenge. She's following this very magnetic leader, Social Democratic Party. Germany has changed dramatically, thank God, since World War II in terms of public opinion. And they're not collectively anti-military, but the German people, younger generation, the younger people especially, starting with the generation that was born right after World War II, relatively young people are not overtly anti-military, but militarism has essentially faded in Germany. And it is very controversial, especially on the political left, to get involved anywhere militarily. They're now facing a major challenge with the war in Ukraine and a traditional enemy, Russia, and before the Soviet Union, and before that, Russia again. There is a basic fundamental terror and horror among Russian people generally of Germany. So it's a very sensitive matter for Scholz to be under pressure from NATO partners, especially Washington, to aid the very successful Ukrainian defense, self-defense against the Russian army, and that at the same time to maintain his political standing. And so far he's finessed it quite well. And Russia has been slowly increasing their aid to Ukraine. The Leopard tank, a lot of a symbol of the Third Reich to a significant degree, was these phenomenal tanks and other armor and artillery. Ground warfare, where they were particularly talented, and brought mechanization to a sort of high art. Leopard tanks going to Ukraine is a particularly important breakthrough, and I try to describe that. I think the Biden administration is to be commended for giving such emphasis to German relations.
You said this at one point in the column: Germany today is ideally positioned to play an increasingly positive as well as powerful role in the affairs of Europe.
Yes, the most powerful economy in Europe. And two people who provide context. One is Henry Kissinger, particularly clear and persuasive. I had the privilege of being in a couple of classes when I was a graduate student so long ago before he went to Washington. And he would regularly emphasize regarding Germany and Europe that a Germany that is secure enough, powerful enough to feel secure, a Germany that's powerful enough to feel secure historically and currently is going to threaten their neighbors. and a Germany that is not considered threatening by their immediate neighbors is inevitably they themselves will be very insecure. And insecurity is something that that culture does not tolerate very well, in contrast to others, especially us.
Right.
I can expand on that. And the other notable figure is Dwight Eisenhower. At the end of the war, when Germany surrendered on May 8, 1945, associates, people on his enormous staff, he had one really tough job, would celebrate the fact that the war has been won, and he would constantly correct people, "We have destroyed the Third Reich. We won't know if the war has been won for about a half century if Germany has rejected militarism and has a stable, law-abiding democracy. A half century from now, if that happens, we'll have won the war." As usual, Ike was seeing down the road to an almost eerie degree. So those are two good guides to European, and Henry is still around. And
fascinating.
Almost 100 years old, I tell you, buddy, I find him inspiring.
Yeah.
He still has very worthwhile things to say and write about.
Absolutely. And I appreciate hearing what you have to say about the new chancellor of Germany. And can you remind us at least roughly how long has he been on the job? At what point?
A couple of years.
Okay, that's what I was kind of thinking. And
not that long, especially, you know, Chancellor Merkel was like FDR. She was around for many.
Right.
Yeah.
And you're right. And she was such a powerful figure. I mean, you know, overwhelming, I would think a lot of people would say in at least mostly positive ways, but I mean, a tough act to follow in more ways than one.
Absolutely. And she was literally a motherly figure. People would refer to her in motherly ways. As a woman, if I might say, ideal for what Germany needs and what neighbors especially needed to see.
Hmm. By the way, as we're talking about Ukraine, I wonder if just for a second, of course, some headlines have been made in terms of China and Russia seeming to kind of tilt towards each other and perhaps in ways that, of course, lead some people to feel great concern. Do you think that's something we need to be watching carefully, the possibility of some kind of new partnership between Russia and China?
Oh, of course. And the Russian regime and Putin are increasingly desperate, and China, which has a growing economy, and their stock markets, Asian stock markets, reflect that, especially the exchanges in China, but also Hong Kong, Taiwan, and elsewhere. The economy is growing, and they have resources that they can provide to Russia. They've also been trying to broker a peace agreement, and President Xi Jinping we're naturally concerned about countries that are rivals, but these dictators, they don't have the... Everybody's insecure, including the leaders of China as well as Russia. So I do believe we exaggerate the actual dangers from these regimes.
Right.
But, yeah, Russia's increasingly dependent on China. It's nothing new. They were communist allies. Mm. In 1958 or 59, there was a basic split between the Soviet Union and China. It went public, the Sino-Soviet split. And throughout the Cold War, they were actually competing with one another.
Mm.
And I can expand on that, but I talk too much anyway. But in Vietnam, I can assure you, in Latin America and Africa, you could see the competition, and that still resonates. So they're not going to be bosom buddies. They're not going to be close partners. It's not like, for instance, the U.S. and NATO, especially our British allies.
Hmm.
It's inherently conflicted.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah, and that's something to keep in mind, because the current focus, the media, always seeking something to express alarm about. They're really overemphasizing the rapprochement between China and Russia.
Right. We're speaking with Dr. Art Sear about a number of different topics of interest and concern. And since I kind of tilted us towards that direction of the globe, let's talk for a moment about something that completely missed me, or I missed it, I should say. namely a very significant agreement reached between the nations of Japan and South Korea. And it's the kind of thing that is significant, and yet mainstream media, including NPR, does just not pay significant attention to, or at least as far as I know. I don't hear every single word on NPR, but at any rate,
I'm sure you hear more than I do.
Right. At any rate, your column is the first that I heard of this really significant agreement between these two nations. And ahead of the agreement, let's talk first about something you say in the column, namely that these two nations, in your words, share a complex, difficult history. I'd appreciate you expanding on that, on kind of the nature of that complex, difficult history, because it helps us then more properly appreciate this new agreement that has been reached between the two nations.
On March 16th, Prime Minister Kishida of Japan and Prime Minister Yoon of South Korea, the Republic of Korea, got together at a restaurant in Tokyo. Long prepared, I can assure you, these weren't just two men, especially given the nature of these governments and cultures.
No accident.
Yeah, and they were able to announce, as soon as they finished lunch, that they'd reached a comprehensive agreement. The complex history is Korea was historically unified until 1945. It's only been since the end of World War II that Korea has been divided in two. And that division turned out to be really important for both sides in the Cold War and beyond. Japan industrialized with astonishing speed in the 1800s, second half of the 1800s, and occupied Korea and became an expansionist country quickly. The beginning of the 20th century, they occupied Korea. It was a particularly brutal takeover. The Queen Nor, was murdered. Almost certainly by Japanese, by the Japanese army. Other significant politicians were all killed. It was a very, very brutal occupation. And after which continued till 1945, Korean men as slave laborers and workers doing the most difficult jobs to support the Imperial Army in the Pacific were exploited, and a lot of young women and girls were forced into prostitution. In 1965, the government of Japan paid a lot of money to South Korea as compensation for these crimes.
Wow.
And this exploitation. In 2018, for some reason, the Supreme Court of South Korea declared that Japanese companies could be sued. They could be legally attacked for compensation to women who were still alive, who'd been exploited. And this opened up a trial lawyer's bonanza and created a terrible mess. And Japan angrily cut off security and intelligence cooperation, which is extremely important since especially the Korean War, I can assure you. And it became a real conflict, and all kinds of ugly old wounds were reopened. At the lunch, they agreed formally, the two leaders, that South Korea, the government, has put together a private foundation supported by Korean corporations, which are enormously powerful and prosperous today, and they will take care of these payments and other things. With the steady rise of China, militarily as well as economically, there's a new series of alliances and collaborative arrangements in the Pacific that's rather like the European Union and NATO in the Atlantic, and is really complicated, and I'm spending part of my time these days trying to study it and write about it. But the Japan-Korea rapprochement is really important, and given this ugly and really terrible history between the two, it really is significant. And you're right, it's been ignored by the... When I'm pitching my column to papers, which I still do, it's not easy, I tell you, these days, I make the point that this story is not being covered, and it really should be.
Right, as opposed to just replowing what's already been plowed quite a lot. You're often sharing important matters that have escaped our notice just because they don't have kind of immediate sizzle or headline appeal.
But. Well, it's anomalous, isn't it? The media is pervasive, and we have far more outlets than ever before, including you and me as individuals. I do maintain a blog, and if you can break through, it's not as concentrated and controlled as big media used to be, but they also have a tendency to just follow one another
right.
very, very quickly. Eugene McCarthy, the very courageous, very eccentric senator who challenged Lyndon Johnson in 1968 and for the nomination and was crucial, really quixotic, and people thought he was crazy, but he did well enough that Robert Kennedy jumped in, came off the fence. Lyndon decided to step down. He was really he would talk. He was not a conventional politician. He would talk disdainfully of the media. They're like a flock of birds on telephone wires. They all fly off together and then come back down together. They're like a bunch of pigeons walking around in a parking lot. And actually, Senator McCarthy was quite accurate with that imagery, I think.
Interesting. Yeah. Guilty as charged.
Yes.
I want to give you a chance to talk about one other thing in this really interesting column about Japan and South Korea, in which you talk about a former leader of South Korea and his really interesting legacy, Kim Dae-jung.
Yes.
Who passed away back in 2009 and apparently was exceptionally courageous in terms of fighting against the dictatorship that was in power at that point in time. And some of what he did and endured is really extraordinary. This is somebody whose story we all need to know better.
Yes, he was a democratic activist for representative government and our kind of freedom throughout his life. Until the 1980s, South Korea was a very rigid and very strict and quite brutal military dictatorship. Park Chung-hee was in charge for about a decade and a half until his own. He was so autocratic and scary, even to his associates, that his own CIA killed him.
Hmm.
It was a very, very different environment from Korea today.
Incredible.
South Korea. And in this context, Kim was quite courageous in promoting democracy and freedom. He was arrested numerous times. There were five or six attempts to kill him. And on one occasion, representatives of the South Korean military and intelligence service took him out. They kidnapped him from a hotel, literally, in broad daylight, took him out on a boat and were going to kill him. And Don Gregg, the CIA station chief in South Korea at the time, and just a phenomenal public servant, again, a very impressive man. I've had the privilege of becoming acquainted with him slightly. He intervened personally. A U.S. military helicopter suddenly was hovering over the boat, and Gregg personally went out there and persuaded these Korean. He was putting himself at risk, actually, although they would think very carefully before killing a U.S. representative, but it was just a terrible situation. Kim Dae-jung survived all this. He survived the dictatorship. All these characters who were doing bad things were gone, and he became president of South Korea. And he got the Nobel Peace Prize in the year 2000 because he established the first direct contact with North Korea. Hmm. Had the first of the summits.
Now that's a good movie. That's a movie that somebody needs to make about.
Very good point. Thank you.
That man's amazing career.
Don Gregg. John Riley, the longtime head of the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. He was the president for 30 years. Leaders who last a long time have to have something. And he hired me, and I worked with him for 20 years. He brought something called the Atlantic Conference to Chicago, bringing 50 leaders from the Atlantic region together, and it really put us on the map. It was a smart thing to do. And I met Don and his wife at one of these conferences, and it was after that I visited South Korea. We developed a very, very large program on Asia. at the council, we raised well over $1 million, which was a lot for a small nonprofit from various sources. And he quite graciously met with me. It was clearly a really busy time. It's always busy for the ambassador in a country like that. But he spent much longer with me than anticipated. My oldest son had just joined the Marine Corps after getting out of college, and Don is very pro-military. He invited me to dinner, so I spent the evening with him and his wife in Seoul. I had the privilege of meeting George H.W. Bush in 1980 at the council. The Illinois primary before the 80s was quite crucial often, and so we would get candidates. Don had been Vice President Bush's national security advisor, and one reason Riley wanted to get him to this conference, and then went on to be ambassador to South Korea during that first very successful Bush administration. He was very much like Bush Sr., just a the old-fashioned northeastern establishment committed to public service, just a phenomenal person, and very smart, and very, very tough. The thing that really impressed me about Bush, contrary to his media image so much of the time, was he was just an extraordinary presence. And Greg was the same way. I believe that the military and intelligence cooperation between us and South Korea ultimately has really paid off in terms of their phenomenal democracy. And Don Gregg really personified that. And it was great with his these old Northeastern types can be really gracious and great company. I just had a wonderful evening. I still remember it.
Yeah. And of course, the kind of the closing thought of this column about this new agreement between South Korea and Japan is that whatever might be worrisome, for instance, in China, we shouldn't let those worries or fears preoccupy us and sort of deter us from appreciating all of these other incredibly positive developments in this really important part of the world.
China does not, an old cliche from the Cold War is Russians are not Germans and Chinese are not Japanese. They are not aggressively expansionist historically. We fought China directly during the Korean War, but they intervened only after General MacArthur, leading the UN forces, did what they had constantly said publicly, isn't we can't stand this, we won't tolerate it. He moved all the way up to the Yalu River and was publicly trumpeting the idea that we should attack China with nuclear weapons and destroy communism, and President Truman fired him. They intervened then. They put up with well over 500,000 U.S. military forces on their southern border, in effect, in South Vietnam, plus 50,000 South Korean combat troops, let me emphasize. And they did not intervene. We could have, I don't know, I don't pretend to predict what's going to happen in international relations any more than the stock market. But there's no high risk of us going to war with China as long as we handle things intelligently.
Right.
Keep our inner MacArthur in the closet.
Yes, very good advice. Let's finish out, and we won't have very much time, I'm afraid, but I do want to touch on a very interesting column that you wrote. I think it might be your most or just about your most recent column on the important topic of arms control, which we don't actually even necessarily hear all that much about. But you sketch kind of the history of those efforts in terms of control of nuclear armaments, among other things, and how certain things are kind of teetering a little bit at the moment. I just want to focus on one thing you say, which is that reductions are desirable, you tell us, but efforts to outlaw all nuclear weapons, that is a fundamentally flawed approach. So I think what you're saying is we should not even have that as a goal. It makes much more sense to talk about reductions. And, of course, that's a goal that's much more doable.
Yes. Well, Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev met at in Iceland for their summit during the Reagan administration, during the president's second term. In Reagan's second term especially, he emphasized the need for accommodation and arms control and agreement. And in an emotional moment, they agreed between themselves, let's promote removal of all nuclear weapons. And I'm sure their staffs went crazy. I know they did. If you remove all nuclear weapons, the duplicitous power that keeps one or two around, or even more, they're going to suddenly be have the whip hand in terms of relations among major powers. That's the only point. But another story that doesn't get much attention is the Russians have, until lately, been very conscientious in maintaining these arms agreements. It's a long history, bipartisan, of reaching accords with the Soviets and now Russia. The START Treaty, which involves actual reductions of nuclear weapons, they abided by that until fairly recently. And the Biden administration has publicly announced that Russia is now no longer abiding by the terms of the treaty in terms of providing data. And Putin is saying quite stridently, well, it's because you have forced us to go to war in Ukraine. Actually, you know, the usual rationalizations that are completely false and self-serving. And so the START Treaty is no longer in effect. The Trump administration, Reagan and Gorbachev, along with this unrealistic public declaration, they did reach a very specific agreement, the INF Treaty, Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, not intercontinental, but shorter range nuclear missiles concentrated in Europe. Getting Germany to accept these things was a big debate and controversy during the Carter administration. Carter quite rightly pressed it, and the Reagan administration was able to reduce the numbers of these. It started with Eisenhower, who I quote at the beginning of the column. He got demilitarization of Antarctica achieved in 1959, which nobody knows about, and that was an initial step that was very helpful to President Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev. And a lot of people know about this. To their great credit, they got a limited test ban treaty to ban nuclear weapons testing in the atmosphere after the Cuban Missile Crisis. It's unhealthy for everyone. We're poisoning the Earth by having nuclear weapons tests in the atmosphere. But until 1963, that was going on. Mm. It shows you just how bad that time was.
Right.
It was a Cold War, but it was still really dangerous and really destructive.
Right. I appreciate so much the way in which you revisit that history and kind of help us understand, you know, the path we have followed thus far, and it gives us some sense of the importance of efforts now to try to sustain some of these efforts and maybe create new ones. Well, as usual, you've given us lots to think about and shared all kinds of interesting information on a lot of different important matters, and I look forward to your visit in May, when we'll be talking, I'm sure, about still further interesting topics and concerns. And I appreciate each and every visit that you pay to the morning show. It's always great to talk
about. We can visit in April, too, if you'd like to.
Yeah, April sounds great.
Okay.
Let's do it. Dr. Art Sear joining us today on WGTD's morning show, a monthly visitor to the morning show. Author of After the Cold War and a columnist whose work appears in newspapers all across the country, and a monthly visitor to the morning show here on WGTD. Tomorrow on the morning show, we'll be introducing you to the new board president of the Kenosha County chapter of NAMI, the National Alliance for Mental Illness, and we'll be talking about some of the good work that they do. Jack Rose, a very frequent guest to the morning show, will be joining us as well. And, of course, you're well acquainted with the good work that Jack Rose does on behalf of NAMI, as he has for many, many years. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org. And you can subscribe to the morning show podcast to enjoy a different morning show 7 days a week. Today will be mostly cloudy. Scattered light rain this morning, a high of 43 degrees. Overnight low of 31. We will see some sunshine tomorrow, Friday, with a high of 43. But late Friday night, early Saturday morning, we will see rain and some snow as well. Saturday's high eventually will be 39 degrees. Sunshine should return on Sunday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. NPR News and Classical.